Christopher Media. Let's make some noise.
I'm sorry. My dad can get cranky sometimes.
As your father, I forbid you to marry.
He sure has a temper on him.
He likes to shout. I like to smile.
You cheesy old cornball.
Imagine me stroking your clitoris with a pink feather. Yeah, that's what I am. I'm a cheesy old cornball.
I kind of like it.
Hey! Stop talking to the customer and help Dad with his shorts.
Imagine if I farted now.
I love you.
Like this?
I don't know if I'm doing it right, Janet. Is this right?
Kiss my juicy cherry lips.
My dad might be the greasy strangler.
I'm officially dating Janet.
I'm the Spider-Man of cocktail.
Bullshit artist.
Bullshit artist.
I call bullshit on that.
Bullshit artist.
You're covered in horse shit.
You can be my forever love.
You claimed her pussy, but you never claimed her heart.
Janet loves me. I love her.
You're making a big mistake.
Jody needs to go now. I am the Greasy Strangler.
You're all right, Braden.
Thanks, Dad. That means a lot coming from you.
Welcome to a special episode of The Projection Booth. I'm here with my good friend Skiz Sizek, and we're talking about The Greasy Strangler.
Hey.
One of my favorite films of the year. And Skiz, if I don't want to put words in your mouth, but perhaps one of yours as well?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I guess the Guy Madden film counts as last year. Yeah. My two favorite new films of the decade, I think.
When did you first see The Greasy Strangler?
I saw it back in May at the Maryland Film Festival. Completely not expecting to see something like that. I don't expect to see something like that at any film festivals. It's so up my alley. You know, I go to a lot of festivals. I like what I see, but rarely do I see films that are where I feel like I was the target audience. And this was one of those cases where my mouth just hung open the whole time. Like, wow, how did this get made? Like, this is so right for me.
I felt exactly the same way. And within 10 minutes, maybe even 5 minutes of watching this film, I was just like, oh my God, this feels perfect.
Yeah.
Just these odd characters in this wonderful world. I mean, odd turns of phrase that they're doing, and everybody is very, very serious about everything that's happening in this film.
Yeah.
It's the story of two men, and a young woman eventually comes into it, and perhaps we could say she comes between them. It's a father and son, Big Ronnie and Big Braden, and eventually Janet comes into the picture, and Big Ronnie is a disco tour guide, showing people all the hot spots where many of yesteryear's best disco hits were recorded.
Well, who likes the Bee Gees? Well, this is where they came up with that fabulous, funky song, Night Fever.
What do you mean, came up with?
They wrote the lyrics while they were standing in this doorway.
Why were they standing in this doorway?
They were waiting for a friend to pick them up. They were going out for Chinese and celebrating his birthday.
Can you verify that, please?
Trust me, I know disco.
And by coincidence, they're all in that same neighborhood.
I know, it's crazy, right?
Yeah.
Okay, disco people, you remember the earth, the wind, and the fire? Did you know that all three of them lived in that apartment up there?
And I love the chemistry between these guys. Michael St. Michaels, who plays Big Ronnie, and Sky Elabar, who plays Big Braden. Wonderful. Watching these two guys fight and bicker and fart at each other.
And walk around naked. Well, sort of naked. You could say walking around with their junk hanging out and think that that's naked, but I'm not so sure.
Well, and when they're not doing that, they're walking around with those wonderful, like, knit outfits.
Yeah.
That just make me itchy and hot looking at them.
Hot, not in a, you mean like temperature wise?
Well, I was hot and bothered. I was hot and bothered this whole way through, especially, you know, watching Big Ronnie just eat so much greasy food.
Yeah, I got to admit, that kind of turned my stomach. If there's one thing in the film that turned my stomach, it was that.
It wasn't the people with their eyes popping out of their heads or...
Nah, I can stomach that.
Yeah, when he dips his dog in that guy's vat of grease.
This isn't right. I need more grease on this. I need more oil.
Sir, I cannot do that. It's against regulations. I could lose my license.
I need this oily. I need this to lubricate the world. I need this dog to have some grease on it. So when I eat it, the grease will lubricate my throat.
Sir, I cannot do that. It's not safe to use too much oil. I could lose my license.
You probably think I'm the greasy strangler. That's why you won't grease my dog.
I got a real kind of, I'll just put it out there. I got a real kind of Napoleon Dynamite vibe from this film.
Yeah, I think the style of the dialogue, I guess it is a natural style of dialogue for some people, but it's not a very normal, like, especially in the movies, you don't tend to see that kind of speech in the movies because it's, I don't know. It's kind of the speech pattern of the person that comes up to you on the street that you don't want to talk to.
The ones who are asking you for money or the ones who are like trying to tell you that President Obama visited Mars?
Yeah, the Mars one.
And I think also the soundtrack with kind of that more like keyboard Casio type sound to it, I think that also helped put me into that mindset.
Yeah, I liked how the soundtrack... It almost sounds like an insult to the film, but I like how the soundtrack would remind me that I'm watching a low budget movie.
Right.
You know, because normally, you know, it would be a rock band or like some really well produced score or whatever. And then here was this sort of lo-fi electronic stuff that, you know, I'm sure was more an aesthetic choice than a budgetary choice. But knowing that it doesn't take much to make that music budget wise, just sort of made me, you know, it brought me back to, oh yeah, you know, this is like, these are just some cool people that got together and made a film. They probably didn't have a ton of money, but this music was good enough, you know, and it works perfectly in that way.
Right. And the movie looks so good for what it is. It's like, it doesn't need to look as good as this.
Right. Yeah. I mean, this could have been shot on just, you know, it could have been shot on an iPhone. Or, you know, just the cheapest DSLR. But I'm going to go out on a limb and just guess that they shot on like a Blackmagic or a Red. Like they went all out and did it as professionally as possible.
Yeah, and it looks great. It sounds great. It's very, very well made. And yeah, just the acting for me is top notch, man. It just, even when you don't have like the best actors in the world, they're put into the right places where their deficiencies actually add to the performance.
Right. I love this in any movie that does it, where every character is a live action cartoon, you know, and this is like a perfect example of that. Like I think of, you know, Forbidden Zone and Existo, and then, you know, this is definitely up there with those.
Like the guy at Oinker who wears a pig nose for like no good reason, but that's his thing. And he just lives in this world. The whole world is just so off kilter.
It looks like a part of Los Angeles, but it feels like some place that none of us could ever find.
And it's kind of a place that I'd like to go to, though.
Yeah. As long as I knew I could get out of it.
Let's go ahead and take a break, and we're going to play an interview with the director of The Greasy Strangler, Mr. Jim Hosking.
I want to know a little bit more about you. How did you get your start in film?
I started working actually at MTV, and I was doing little commercials sort of for them, you know, the ones that are just the sort of weird little commercials with the MTV logo at the end that could be about sort of anything in particular. And I was sort of writing those and then started directing some. And after that, I was signed by a production company for sort of commercials and music videos. And I was sort of making some of that kind of stuff, and then made some short films, and I suppose one of them got into Sundance about 5 years ago, a short film I made called Renegades, which I think some people saw and liked. And then they got in touch with Andy Stark, who is Ben Wheatley's producer, and Andy sort of started working with me on a project. And even though that one's yet to happen, we did end up making a short film for the ABCs of Death 2 that he produced, that I directed, and then ended up feeding into the Greasy Strangler. Anyway, that's quite a long-winded answer for you.
Well, were you working at MTV New York or MTV London?
I was working at both, actually. I sort of started at the one in New York and then moved back to London. But I was living in New York at the time.
Would I have seen any of your bumpers?
I don't think so, actually, because I think quite a lot of the ones that I did, I was writing. And then the ones that I did direct were kind of smaller, weirder ones. And I was definitely quite out of step with, I suppose, just the sort of general work that was being made there. There was a lot of stuff that sort of felt like it was kind of quite trying to be quite hip or trying to be quite current. And I think that I've always kind of gone against the grain a little bit. I'm not sure why, but I sort of have quite a sort of contrary nature. So I can remember there's one sort of campaign that I did for a TV show they had that was about sex, I think, like young people and sex. And I did these ones with this old man who was hanging out with a puppet who was a dragon who was really obsessed with sex and wanting to know all about sex, and kept sort of asking the old man sort of prying questions about whether he had ever had any threesomes and, you know, what it was like to have sex and stuff. And the old man just really didn't want to talk about it and kept saying to him that he needed to watch that the dragon should watch this show on MTV, and that's how he could learn about it. So I was kind of doing stuff like that, which I thought was funny, but I don't know, I sort of got the feeling that people were a little bit perplexed by it, but I feel I've always had a sort of perplexness around me.
So how long were you making commercials for?
I still do them, you know, when I need to earn some money. I'd say about 14 years or something now. Quite a long time.
I have looked at a lot of the commercials on your reel, and I have to say I'm very impressed with them. And I want to know, when did you meet Sam Disanayake?
I met Sam when I was making this TV commercial in LA, and he came in, and I don't know, I just felt like he just seemed so extraordinary to me, or just really appealed to me in the way that he is sort of quite odd, obviously, but then at the same time, he's very, very sort of sweet and very genuine and sincere and sort of quite innocent. And I mean, I'm always really, really drawn, I think, to that combination of oddness and sort of sweetness or innocence. And he's an Indian guy with a very high voice and a lisp, and he sort of blinks quite furiously, but beyond that, he's also very proper and, like, you know, he's a real sort of gentleman. So I cast him immediately, and then I've worked with him a few times, I think, actually, now.
When did you meet, or how did you meet Toby?
I met Toby, I would say, maybe 12 years ago or something now. He was storyboarding some TV commercials for me, and he's done that to this day. But I think within about a year and a half or something of us working together, we would always talk about films and talk about, you know, the kind of films that we liked, and I always found his taste to be quite strange. He seemed to sort of listen exclusively to hip hop and only be interested in action films, and yet he was clearly very, very bright and deep thinking, sort of quite philosophical. And I couldn't tell if he was sort of sincerely into this stuff or whether he was sort of being ironic or posturing or something. But we started talking about maybe writing something together. I think he was asking me whether I'd ever wanted to make any films, and I said, yeah, of course. You know, I've been writing scripts for 5 years, but not in a particularly sort of committed way, but just sort of writing really peculiar, completely uncommercial, probably unfinanceable scripts, if financeable is a word. And then we decided to have a crack at writing something, and we wrote our first script together, I would say it was probably about 9 years ago, and we've probably written about 10 or something together now. But yeah, we're always having ideas for new scripts. First one that we wrote was called Diabolical Exploitation, and I don't know quite how many people we've shown it to. I remember showing it to my first AD, who I worked with a lot at the time, who absolutely loved it because it has this sort of very peculiar last, I suppose, the last act of it or something. It was about these kind of immigrants who are sort of force-fed drugs to make them sort of work really hard in these sort of factories and stuff, and they end up building this massive kind of Viking boat for exploiters of these immigrants. I'm not really expressing myself very clearly, but anyway, it's kind of a very surreal, peculiar script. But that was the first one that we wrote. But yeah, we've written a bunch since then. I mean, but they're sort of, I would say The Greasy Strangler probably sits squarely in the middle of sort of how commercial or uncommercial they may be. We've written some that are more peculiar and less enticing to potential financiers.
I know that this is a very annoying question, but I have to ask it anyway. Where does an idea like The Greasy Strangler come from?
Just to even get to sort of where that kind of idea comes from is it's not even about, you know, what the script will end up being about. I think it's more just a kind of like a mindset of what is it that, you know, that I'm feeling that I want to be doing at that particular time, or what does it strike me and Toby that we want to do, you know. When you decide that you want to make something that's really going to stand out and do its own thing, and you want to make a film or write a script that sort of that has very little concessions to sort of how a script should be conventionally, or how a film should be. That's kind of where it started, I think. I was feeling, after having written some other scripts, that I just wanted to write something quicker that was sort of self-indulgent and just totally sort of pleasing myself. And then Toby felt the same. And then I suppose from there, you know, we had this idea pretty quickly about this guy sort of being a greasy strangler. I mean, it was sort of like this image that kind of, I feel like it was an image that sort of popped into my head, but I may be deluded about it. I've found this email chain between us where it looked like I said that I wanted to write a script for this actor Carl that I know in LA, who's kind of a peculiar guy, and then Toby replied he could be a greasy strangler, and then I replied to Toby the greasy strangler. But the way that I also remember it was, I sort of remember being in the shower and just having this vision of this guy who was sort of covered in this kind of light brown, kind of sludgy, sort of porridgey sort of stuff, with a kind of leering look on his face and his arms stretched out like he was sort of wanting to strangle somebody. And then I don't really know where these ideas come from, other than I have a lot of visuals that come to mind, and then when something just feels distinctive enough or different or odd enough or just makes me laugh enough, or if I speak to Toby and we think that this thing just feels really sort of magical somehow, then it feels like it's something to pursue, you know. And also, and part of the fun, I think, is to not know how it will end up being, or, you know, whether it can even sustain a feature film, or what the story will be, what the other characters will be, and just to sort of really embrace the kind of freedom and the insecurity of it, because I suppose I get a little bit demotivated or sort of switch off a bit when I feel like it's obvious where I'm heading, or that something is kind of feels predictable in any way or feels mapped out. It sort of needs to feel more like I don't know whether I should be doing this or not. Like, that's probably when I get most excited. But then it is, you know, you can also feel quite insecure when you're making stuff like that. But I do like the feeling of I don't know quite what I think about this. So with something like The Greasy Strangler, it was also attractive to me, I suppose, because I don't generally watch any kind of horror films really, or sort of creature films or anything else. It was kind of very much out of my, well, people say wheelhouse, I can't stand that word, but it's sort of out of what I do, you know. It's not the kind of thing that I generally would write about, and then that felt really interesting to me. You know, you sort of get yourself in that kind of headset where you just let things kind of come to you a little bit, and it's a bit like dreaming things or something, you know.
How organic is the script once you guys have your first or second draft of this? How much does it change from that until it comes to the screen?
You're probably asking whether it changes sort of from a creative point of view. Like, I would decide to change this element of it, or to you know, shift this scene to somewhere else or whatever else. But I feel like it's kind of affected more by boring sort of logistical issues and sort of budgetary issues than anything else. I mean, I'm quite keen to, once the script is kind of written to our satisfaction, I sort of feel like, well, we work sort of quite hard to create dialogue, I think, that we really, really like, and we like the idea of other people speaking these words. And of course, there is some, you know, there's some latitude there, and I definitely encourage improvising at times. But I do kind of like to stick with where the script is to a certain extent, because that's just, you know, it's like that's why I'm making this film. It's not like I want to tear it all apart and then create something new, or at least so far I haven't done that. Although I do quite like the idea of possibly making a film with no sort of prescribed dialogue and just more like a list of intentions and a list of scenes. But so far it's been very specific, sort of peculiar dialogue, I suppose. So therefore you kind of want to stick quite close to that to preserve that singular world.
You touched on this a little bit before, but I am curious as far as the nuts and bolts, as far as how the film got made. You know, how was this project financed, and, you know, you got the backers and all of this kind of stuff?
I was working on another film project with Andy Stark, who runs Rook Films with Ben Wheatley. And while working with Andy, he asked me if I wanted to shoot one of the short films that would make up the ABCs of Death 2. And I said, yeah, sure. And so I made the G for Granddad segment of that. And the ABCs of Death 2 was produced by Drafthouse Films, so Tim League, and also Ant Timpson of Timpson Films. And I guess they liked what I did. And by this stage, I'd shown Andy Stark the script for The Greasy Strangler, and he really liked it, although he had one sort of reservation, which was that he wondered whether I would ever find any cast who would be prepared to perform some of the material that's in the script. But I sort of felt pretty confident that I could. And then and after Ann Simpson and Tim Lee had sort of come on board, then Ann asked me if I would mind him showing the script to Elijah Wood, who runs Spectrevision. And I said, no, of course. And so Elijah read it, and so did Josh Waller and Daniel Noah of Spectrevision, and they wanted to come on board. And I remember the first thing that they said was, you know, we need to make this film, because if we all don't make it, then nobody else will make it. And there was just a sort of feeling of, when you're trying to get a film made, you probably either want to make something that's really got some obvious appeal, and whether it fits in some sort of classic kind of genre, or it's just a really sort of well-executed, you know, classic sort of script, a thriller or whatever it might be. Or you write something that's just different to whatever else might be out there, that if you find, you know, it's kind of, I was lucky to find the right people who wanted to get behind it, but I guess they wanted to finance it and make it because they just, it, you know, it really sort of tickled them in the same way that it tickled me. But I think that I could have shown it to almost anybody else and they wouldn't have wanted to get behind it. So I was very lucky.
How did you find Michael St. Michaels and Sky Alibar?
Well, I was doing a casting for actually what will be my next film, but I was doing a casting for that about 6 months before I went into pre-production on The Greasy Strangler. And then for that casting, Michael St. Michaels came in to read for that. And so I met him there, and I just sort of kept him logged in my head. You know, I just found him so sort of extraordinary looking in his manner. And I don't know, you don't come across people who look like that back in the UK. It's just, he just seems so memorable and original to me. And actually in the same casting, I also had, Gil Jets, who plays, Paul, who's the blind car wash owner in The Greasy Strangler. He also came in and he read with Michael St. Michaels for this other project. And so I nabbed him as well. And then, I don't know if you asked about Sky Alibar, but Sky, who's the son, I've worked with a couple of times in a couple of short films that I've done. And he was in my head when I was writing the script with Toby. We sort of had Sky in our heads as the son, but it was always a question of who could be his dad. And so, I don't know, when I thought of Michael St. Michaels, it suddenly seemed to fit into place, whether it was their sort of long flowing hair or they've both got a kind of innocence and sweetness about them. Again, I suppose, like I was talking about Sam earlier, there's something I think about all of the characters in the film that they're quite endearing and quite sort of guileless. I think that sort of helps because the film is kind of, you know, it is quite perverted, and the characters do some pretty reprehensible things in the films, so it's quite nice. They're also quite sweet, lovable, innocent characters, almost kind of like children. I think that's sort of, maybe that's why some people find the film quite disturbing or makes them feel quite uneasy, is that there's a sort of sweetness that happens at the same time as the sort of perversion that maybe is a bit of a peculiar combination.
Everybody in the film is fantastic, but I have to say that your two leads, they tear it up. And nothing, you know, not taking away from Elizabeth DeRozzo either, because she does an amazing job too, but just that chemistry between Michael St. Michaels and Sky Elibar, just, you can just watch them for hours. They are amazing.
That's great, yeah. I think some people, judging by a couple of reviews I've read in the last, or the last sort of 24 hours, some people might disagree. No, I mean, that's the nature of this film, I think, is a sort of, it is definitely quite polarizing. But yeah, I do think they both give it everything. And that's one thing about this film that, or even the most, you know, my most favorite thing about this film is the sheer sort of gusto and the commitment that the cast give to their performances. And they're just so committed to the film, and it was really touching, and I think it just makes the film feel very special. I think that's what I was wanting when I was casting it, was I was wanting to cast unknowns and to create a new kind of weird little world for the viewer to sort of drop in on, so that they could feel completely surprised by it and sort of lost within it. And I always imagine that if you saw a trailer for The Greasy Strangler, this was even before casting it, that you should feel like you didn't really have any reference point on any of the people in the film, or the kind of clothes they were wearing, or where it was, anything about it, that it would just feel like this strange, like, you know, what the hell is this? Like, who are these people? And that it would feel really sort of committed and sort of powerfully performed, and like with real emotion and sincerity. And so even though it is obviously quite an absurd film, but at the same time it's played with such passion, and I think that it's quite moving in a funny way. Well, to me anyway.
Well, you do a fantastic job of creating this whole world where all of these kind of interesting people all live. And where did you end up shooting this at?
We shot this in the less desirable areas of Los Angeles. I think when I was saying to friends of mine back here in London that I was going off to shoot a film in LA, they were presuming that I was going to go somewhere really, really swanky and live it up and create something rather glitzy. But it's sort of quite the opposite. I mean, as you can see, but we ended up, yeah, shooting in quite a sort of downtrodden area where the house is, and the house was really dirty and sort of degraded and felt like it genuinely hadn't sort of been cleaned for about 40 years. There's a guy living in the house who's a sort of colossal hoarder. And, I suppose it was quite an oppressive environment in a way for the crew to work in. Or at least everybody seemed to be wearing these face masks to try and keep the sort of dust out of their nostrils, but it didn't really bother me that much. But I don't know whether that's just I come from a sort of an older, more archaic country where we're just used to sort of filth and squalor and degradation. But yeah, so we shot, and then we shot downtown in LA, and we shot a little bit in Hollywood. We shot the motel was in Hollywood, and then we went off to, I think it's called Angeles Crest. There's a forest outside LA to shoot the last part of the film.
Well, I'm amazed that you could find a place where all of these legends of disco had recorded all of these great songs.
Well, we were very, very lucky, Mike. It took a lot of planning, but we managed to do it. We managed to find all the legendary disco spots.
That's amazing. Yeah. To think that they were all so close to one another as well.
I know. Yeah, absolutely. Within spitting distance, they were all there. Yeah. Yes, it's not very factual, the film, let's be honest. Although, I don't know, there was a producer friend of mine who read the script quite early on, who said to me very sincerely, said, oh, I absolutely love the script, Jim. And also, it's really, really good to learn quite a lot about disco as well. And I really didn't have the heart to say to him, come on.
I do have some really nerdy questions.
No, go for it.
What did you end up using for the grease that they were putting on themselves?
Gosh, I've been asked this quite a lot, and I have to say, I can't say that I'm 100% sure. I do know some of the ingredients. Well, there's something that they use in, like, in Alien or whatever, where when the alien comes out of John Hurt's stomach and it's sort of dripping with goo, and I think it's called methyl cellulose or something or other. But there was this substance that's called Ultra Ice, which I think gave it a real sort of greasy kind of sheen. So that was plastered all over the greasy strangler, and it was very, very, very icy, actually, the stuff. It made Michael really, really cold, and he spent his whole time sort of shivering and had to stand underneath heaters in, you know, various sort of side streets and car parks, and sort of chain smoking, furiously shivering. I think he had quite a rotten time. But beyond that, I think there was actually also sort of grease and stuff as well. There was sort of there, but various kind of substances. There were these two girls in the makeup special effects department who had about six buckets, and they would sort of trawl these buckets around and then slop a load of stuff on Michael for sort of different handfuls of this, like a smear of some brown goo here. And I'd sort of say, okay, a bit more brown in the hair. Can I have some more of this one on the face, and this bit down the back, and then this bit on his Johnson, and then we'd be ready to roll.
I could tell that Sky was wearing kind of a bodysuit at the end, but when it came to Michael being greasy, was he all natural when he was being covered with this?
No. He was also wearing a suit as well. They were both wearing suits. When I was envisaging the film, I sort of wanted them to both be naked and covering grease, and then obviously that's totally impractical when it comes to having to sort of reset, you know, for shots, and whether there's sort of grease on other people's clothing or all over the location, whatever else. But so then we were going to put them in these skin-tight kind of spandex suits, but those, I think they were, the cost of them was quite prohibitive, so it ended up being a sort of slightly thicker suit. And it did end up, it sort of ended up looking a bit more like a suit than I originally intended, but I think that's the, you know, that's kind of the hard thing and also the fun thing about making films that are quite ambitious for the, you know, for the budget, is that you do end up seeing everything kind of evolving and then having to sort of react to that. And, you know, they ended up looking a little bit different to how I intended, but then that also made the effects in the film, the sort of the CG VFX, like I wanted those to become a little more exaggerated as a result of the suits being sort of slightly more obviously like suits. And, you know, you sort of jiggle things around to try and keep the world feeling like it makes sense. So, if you know what I mean.
Was that Michael St. Michael's junk that we were seeing in the film, or was that a stunt cock?
That was a prosthetic, yeah. He sort of plugged his real junk into the fake junk, and then he was ready to go. He was also wearing this sort of, his disco costume that had a sort of diamond-shaped panel with a sort of mesh covering that you could see his junk through. And there's one scene where he's sitting with Janet in a park and he's talking to her about his sort of legendary disco days where he was hanging out with Michael Jackson, and he sort of spreads his legs quite widely, and I really wanted to see his penis within the diamond-shaped mesh window, and it just kept going off to the side and wasn't visible, and I sort of went over and I was saying to Michael, could you just move it a little bit to the right? I can't really see it at the moment. He'd try and move it, and it wasn't really working. And I said to him, Michael, can I have a go and try and move it? And he was like, yeah, go on, go for it. And so I started sort of fiddling with this thing and moving it. And I mean, it's not a particularly good story, but I said to him, it was about midnight. It was a really, really long day. And I was sort of thinking, oh, God, really? Is this really what it's come to? This sort of end of a really long day, and I'm fiddling with this prosthetic. And I said to him, God, it feels really, really weird, this prosthetic. I thought it was just sort of like a light silicon thing. He said, well, that's not actually the prosthetic you're feeling at the moment. That's my cock. So there we have it. It was quite hard to manipulate, I'll say that much.
Can you tell me about who did the music for the film?
The music was conceived and performed by Andrew Hung, who is in electronic duo called Fuck Buttons in the UK. And Andy makes this amazing music on his own that's kind of sort of quite demented sort of electronic music, I suppose, that's sort of, I don't know, it's got this kind of jaunty, fun kind of feel, but at the same time feels like it's kind of quite dark and sinister and strange. And it just seemed to, just his musical aesthetic, I suppose, just felt like it was just perfectly the right sound for the film. I think that I wanted the film to definitely not sound like disco in any way, you know, like I didn't want the music to sound like disco, just in the same way that they were going to these disco landmarks and those are completely spurious. I also wanted the music to just sound like something else too. Yeah, I sort of showed Andy Hung the film and had a chat with him about it, but I kept it pretty loose for him to sort of go where he wanted to, because I think you try and get the most out of your collaborators by really letting them bring a lot of themselves to it. So I don't know. I thought he did a really brilliant job. I love it.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's fantastic. And it gets stuck in your head too.
Yeah, it definitely does. It's definitely, if you're not into it, it's probably the most maddening music on the planet. I think that's the thing with this film, is that you're either really into it or you're really not. And you definitely see that. You definitely see that with people when they sort of come out, they're either sort of very energized and enthused, or they look like they've just been sort of smashed around the face with a, you know, large halibut.
Well, I did want to ask, how was the reaction when you showed this at Sundance? Was there a lot of halibut smashing?
Well, yes, there was quite a lot of that. Well, actually, I'll tell you what, it was interesting, because the first screening, which was I think we were the first of the midnight films to screen on the Friday night. So yeah, we had a midnight screening and there was a lot of anticipation, I think. But I think that people were maybe thinking that this was going to be a certain kind of film, like a sort of like a scary film or a, I don't know, like a horror film or something. I think it kind of took them by surprise a lot. I think some people were probably quite sort of nonplussed, or I don't know, were just trying to sort of process it. There was a strange sort of feeling at the end of the film when I kind of went up to do the Q&A and invited the three main actors up. So I invited Sky and Michael and Liz up to do the Q&A, and Charlie Reff from Sundance, who's moderating the Q&A, asked three of them a question first and said, "So you guys have never seen the film, right?" And they said, "No." And he said, "What did you think?" And they were just completely silent, really. I think they couldn't think what to say for about 20 seconds. And then Sky just said, "Oh, wow, disgusting." And it was just like, I think that people seemed to be really, I don't know if unnerved is the right word, but just sort of not sure what to think, really, which I think is quite interesting. I mean, it's nice to go and see films and to sort of feel like you're not quite sure what you think. I think then, you know, then it means that it's doing something a bit different. I don't know, making you think in a different way. But then with the second screening the following day, I think that maybe people started talking about the film a bit or something, and so people knew a little bit more what to expect, and it was really sort of totally different experience. They were really raucous and sort of rapturous and really laughing loads and really up for it. And it just seemed to transform overnight. It was quite interesting.
And you've played some of what I would consider some of the best festivals for a movie like this to play, with Fantasia and Fantastic Fest. I mean, what's been the reaction overall? Is it pretty consistent?
I think I've only been to four festivals myself. I've been to like Sundance, and then I went to Sundance London. And I went to South by Southwest as well. That was really, really good. I went to a festival in the Czech Republic called Karlovy Vary, and that was brilliant, actually. It was really, I don't sit there and watch the whole film each time. I think that would drive me completely barmy, but because I really have seen it enough. But I did sit in there for 5 or 10 minutes at the beginning and the end in the Czech Republic, and there were subtitles there as well in Czech, and it was really fun to see a sort of predominantly foreign crowd just really laughing and getting into it. And I suppose, like, in a way, some of the dialogue is quite strange, and maybe even if you speak English, and or if you're English or American or whatever, you know, there might be some little moments that you don't quite get, but I think with the subtitles, you just got the feeling that they were really able to sort of get the most out of the madness. I think it's gone down pretty well, yeah. I mean, you know, I think it's just a fact, though, with this film, and I think with any films that really sort of go somewhere a little bit different, that some people love that and some people hate it, and I think that's just the nature of it. It's a bit like, I don't know, it's a bit like, you know, when there's a new musical movement and you either like, I mean, it's probably a bit of a crass analogy, but you think of something like punk and then that comes along and some people are either really fascinated by that or really intrigued, and then other people are just kind of disgusted and sort of think, well, this isn't music. I had another director at Sundance who was saying to me that he was really keen to see the film, and I said to him, yeah, well, come along, you know, it's on Friday night, last screening, come and see it, you know. He was like, yeah, you know, I really want to see it. And I was like, yeah, come along, come and check it out. And he came along, and then after I'd introduced the film, I went to a bar a couple of doors down, and he'd walked out of the film, I think, after about 20 minutes with his editor. They both walked out, and he came to this bar and found me there and was saying to me, you know, that's not cinema. That film you made, that's not cinema. He just kept saying that to me. And I think you just get these extreme reactions, you know, which is, in a way, I think that's really great. I mean, it's kind of how I have felt when I've seen films that I really, really love and connect to, is it kind of feels like it's almost like it's been made specially for you, you know. It's kind of like being in on something, or I'm not saying it's meant to be elitist, exclusive thing. It's really not. I mean, I genuinely tried to make something that I thought would be really fun and kind of just an antidote to sort of just predictable formulaic filmmaking. I thought this is the kind of thing that I would love to see and be surprised by or be ambushed by. You know, I'm constantly looking for films that take me to unexpected places and often feel quite sort of let down, but you can't please everybody.
Well, I'll tell you that what you just said about this film feels like it was made for me, that was exactly my reaction. I think that's exactly what I posted on Facebook when I was watching this the first time, that this movie feels like it was made for me. And I reached out to another friend of mine who has very similar tastes, and I said, have you seen The Greasy Strangler? He said, yeah, I caught it at a festival screening, and it's a movie that's made for us. And I'm like, exactly.
Oh, that's great, yeah.
So it is cinema to somebody. It is cinema to me.
Yeah, but also, I mean, what is, you know, yeah, but I mean, like, what is cinema anyway? I don't know. I mean, who could, like, I don't know what gives anyone the right to be saying what cinema is. I think that's a bit of a daft thing to say, personally.
Thank you so much, Jim. This has been a real pleasure talking with you, and I'm so glad that we were able to connect.
Oh, thanks, Mike. No, it's my pleasure. Absolutely, yeah. I hope I hope I've said something of some interest along the way, and I'm really glad you liked it. And I did make it just for you.
Oh, thank you. Wow.
That was director Jim Hosking talking about the creation of The Greasy Strangler. And yeah, it is now available. I believe it's playing theatrically. I know it's out on VOD. And I have to say that this film is not for everyone. I will not say that everybody is going to enjoy this. And I would say that something like, and I don't want to just dismiss this and or keep coming back to Napoleon Dynamite, but Napoleon Dynamite is one of those divisive films where it's you love it or you hate it. It's one of those films that was just this big X factor out on Netflix when they were trying to tell what your taste is. They didn't really know what to recommend if you had like loved that film. And I would say that this is kind of along those lines as far as it's going to be very divisive. There are going to be some people that just think that I'm absolutely insane for recommending it. And then other people, and I hope the right people find this movie because it is such a joy.
I've been really happy seeing lots of posts about it on social media, seeing a lot of other people really excited by it. People that I wouldn't have guessed would like this kind of film. It gives me a lot of hope that, and these are all people I know from the film festival world. So it gives gives me hope that people are finally growing out of mumblecore and willing to take a risk on something else. And maybe the festivals are starting to realize that there are other kinds of films and there are audiences for those films. At the same time, I hope that it doesn't start a trend where everybody suddenly wants to make the weirdest, you know, whereas everybody for so many years has wanted to make the most mumbly film. I hope people aren't going to start trying to make the weirdest film and outdo each other, because while that would be really fun for a little while, I would hate to see it become a genre that I get really tired of. But I mean, if they're all as good as the Greasy Strangler, would bring them on, I suppose.
I mean, you lived through the film festival submission process when everybody was trying to make the next Reservoir Dogs.
Oh, yeah.
I think that if everybody was trying to make the next Greasy Strangler, it might be okay. I don't know.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see. I mean, it's funny that you mentioned Napoleon Dynamite, because I don't remember everybody trying to make the next Napoleon Dynamite.
Right.
I would have welcomed that, but what came instead was mumblecore, which I don't mind, but I just got really tired of it. There was just so much of it. I think maybe the reasons why that caught on so much is because it wouldn't take as much effort to make a mumblecore film as it would to make Greasy Strangler or Napoleon Dynamite. I think maybe that's it. It's effort. It's so much easier to make. Like when something really easy to make becomes in style, a lot more people are going to jump on that bandwagon. But to make a Greasy Strangler, you have to have a great idea. You have to have people dedicated to that vision. You got to be creative.
Yeah, nobody is half-stepping it at all in this one.
Right. I mean, all those roles are pretty daring. I mean, the cast, I wouldn't have taken any of those roles. You know, I'm glad they did, but I don't think I could have done it.
Yeah, I don't see me being able to pull off a Big Braden or any of that stuff. I mean, not even the Scandinavian tourist.
Okay, I guess there were some people in the cast that would be a little easier to play than others. But
do you know what I think I saw the other day? You know, that new Tom Hanks movie, well, not that new anymore, but Sully.
Yeah.
And on Jimmy Kimmel, I want to say, they were doing a parody of the Sully film, but it was a movie about Tom Hanks where Sullenberger was playing Tom Hanks. And Tom Hanks's rival was being played like this kind of like crazy guy who was like, I'll get you, Tom Hanks. He was being played by Sky Elibar, I believe.
Oh, wow.
So it was really nice, like, oh, hey, I know that guy. I mean, he's got such a distinct voice, and he's kind of got like this almost Judah Friedlander look to him, yeah, but a little more scraggly. But yeah, it was like, oh, this is a surprise. So I'm excited to see him popping up more.
I did the Q&A at Maryland Film Festival for one of the screenings, and Sky was there, Sky Elibar. If I remember correctly, he put on a ton of weight to play that role. I seem to remember him telling us that, because I was thinking that he didn't look the same in person as he did in the film, which, you know, that's the magic of movies. But he had mentioned that he'd put on a bunch of weight just to play that role. He was wearing one of the official Greasy Strangler knit caps. Have you seen this?
Yeah, it looks like grease, but greasy.
Yeah, it's like pink and everything. I think he said that at Sundance, they ran into the producer from the movie Grease, who was really offended by his hat. He was like, you can't do that. He's like, we did. Yeah. He's like, what do you mean we can't do it? I'm wearing a hat.
Yeah, you can't really copyright a font. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
A font. Well, I suppose you can. Yeah, but
a font in the shape of a car. But
right. I just couldn't get over his performance and Michael St. Michael's performance. I mean, just totally fearless. And really, Elizabeth Durazzo as well. I mean, she pretty much bears it all in the film. And it's nice to see an actual woman who's got real curves and everything, not your typical, you know, twiggy kind of, you know, fey, angsty young actress that you would maybe see in some of these mumblecore films that you're talking about.
Right. And, you know, I thought she was beautiful.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, you're right. You don't see that body type, especially naked, in movies very often, unless it's, you know, meant to shock and offend or disgust or whatever. In this case, it was shocking. I mean, everything in the movie was shocking, but it wasn't offensive. It was, you know, I thought she was very attractive in this film.
Yeah, and she is, again, completely fearless with the role. And it was great that she's the center of this love triangle, which is, you know, very unusual for someone of her body type to be that. And she, again, gives a terrific performance. She just fits into that kind of whacked out universe that this film presents to us.
I mean, delivering lines like Rudy Tootie Disco Cutie over and over again with that much conviction. Yeah, she was wonderful. I don't really know her from anything else. I'm looking at her IMDb page right now, and I would not have recognized her from the pictures on IMDb.
Oh, yeah. No, without that crazy curly wig and stuff. And yeah, she looks completely different. I can't say au naturel because we kind of saw her au naturel, but completely different with her regular hair and makeup on.
Kudos to the makeup department.
I already mentioned those amazing knit outfits that they were in. Her outfits are pretty amazing as well. I mean, everybody looks so good in this, and just kind of like weird hand-me-down kind of stuff, yeah. You know, or custom outfits. I mean, Big Paul, he's definitely a snazzy dresser.
Wait, which one's Big Paul?
I think he's the guy who runs the car wash.
Oh, okay, yeah. I'm just sitting here thinking about the film, and like these scenes keep popping into my head. That the scene where it's a Big Ronnie talking to what's her name, Janet, on a park bench, and the comic timing in the editing where it suddenly cuts to a wide shot and he's doing like an extreme man spread, you know, and it was just sort of like the scene already is like hilariously absurd, and then it just with one edit it gets even more absurd. I can't wait to watch this film again.
Oh, I know. It's one of those where when I watched it the first time, I was just like, I can't wait to see this again, and I can't wait to share it with people.
Yeah, I can't wait to see which friends I recommend it to that come back and hate me for life. I've lost friends over Forbidden Zone, so I'm sure I'll lose some over Greasy Strangler.
Well, at least with Greasy Strangler, I mean, it wears its weirdness on its sleeve, and it's right there from the beginning. I mean, if you get 5-10 minutes into this film and you don't like it, don't stick around. It's not going to change.
I can just hear somebody right now going, why did they keep saying bullshit artist?
Oh, my God. Oh, I love it. I love it. I'm thinking about getting one of those bullshit artist t-shirts. That and then the way that Big Ronnie keeps talking about how Braden would shit all over the place. Oh, so many good things.
Yeah, I have not seen the film enough to be able to quote it, but I know that, you know, once I get my hands on a copy and I watch it a million times, I'm going to be quoting the phone sex scene left and right. I don't even remember what he says. I just remember laughing so hard in the theater when I saw it. I probably shouldn't be bringing it up because maybe when I finally see it again, it won't be what I remembered. But yeah, that's one that stuck out.
Well, thank you, Skiz, for coming on and talking about The Greasy Strangler. You're the only other person I know who has seen it that could talk cogently about it. So I'm glad that you were not a bullshit artist today.
Cool. Thanks for having me.
So, Skiz, where can people keep up with you?
I have this really poorly designed website, www.skiz.net. That's S-K-I-Z-Z. Every so many weeks or so, I will update the schedule page of what I'm up to, which is mostly band gigs, but occasionally film festivals and film screenings. And if I've written something that's been published or if I'm acting in a movie that's showing around, it's all in there somewhere.
How is Ice Pick to the Moon, the documentary about the Reverend Fred Lane?
It's getting there. It's been a long time coming for anybody that isn't familiar with this project. I've been working on it since 1999. So just about everybody who knows me has heard me talk about this film. And the fourth rough cut was just finished yesterday. It's finally under 2 hours long, but I still have about 25 minutes to cut out. And it's 25 minutes of some pretty painful cuts, I fear.
Killing all your darlings?
Yeah. Yeah. Just trying to figure out, like, whatever's left right now, I want, but I can't keep it all in there. It's better to not have enough, I guess.
Well, you just do like Showa and make it 8 hours long.
Yeah. You know, that idea comes up on every film that I make, and I'm always kind of glad when they're done that I didn't go that route.
Multi-part PBS special that runs all week during Pledge Week.
Yeah. Well, I just figure, like, the amount of interest in the 90-minute versions of my films, that's what makes me glad that there aren't 8-hour versions. Because there would be even less interest.
If you enjoy this show and want more people to know about it, head on over to iTunes, leave a comment, and rate it 5 stars. Make sure you like and share us on Facebook, and don't forget to follow us on Twitter. Just search for Christopher Media. Thank you in advance for supporting Christopher Media by clicking on the PayPal button and by clicking through to all the sponsors who support ChristopherMedia.net. Most importantly, we would like to take the time to extend an extra special thanks to you. Christopher Media could not exist without your support. Thank you for visiting ChristopherMedia.net, and thank you for listening. Christopher Media, let's make some noise.
This very store here is where Cool from Cool and the Gang worked before he exploded onto the disco scene. Anyway, this is the end of Big Ronnie's disco tour. Thank you very much for coming, and come again soon.